Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2023 Youth Education Conference held in Salt Lake City, Utah.
I want to start with an activity that I do sometimes with my classes. And before we start, I just want to get some, I want to make sure that we agree. Do you all know what a bowl is? Like a bowl, the sort of, that you would eat cereal out of. Not like a skiing, like when you're skiing and they've got like a bowl in the mountain you would ski down, but like a bowl. Not B-U-L-L, bowl, B-O-W-L. Can we agree? Because you're going to want to back up from this later. Later on, you're like, no, the bowls don't even exist. This is what you're going to want to do later. So I just want to start by establishing, do you know what a bowl is? You all know. Okay. So, and can we further agree that you would not have trouble figuring out what is or isn't a bowl? If like someone marched a motorcycle in front of you, you wouldn't be like, I'm not so sure. I don't know. You would be able to say, not a bowl. Someone puts a cereal bowl in front of you, you'd be like, yes, a bowl. Okay, good. Because that commits you now. You cannot at this point be like, bowls don't even exist. Okay? Sound good. Okay. Given that you all know what a bowl is, clearly, I mean, it's obvious, because you can point out what is and what isn't a bowl, and you have a definition in your mind, I would like you to please define a bowl for me. Just let me know what that is. What's a bowl? Yeah, go ahead, Winter.
A bowl is a semicircular shape, but like also like this. It's a, I don't know what that's called. Semicircular shape, but like a ball. It's like a ball cut in half and it's hollow.
A ball cut in half, hollow. Okay. I thought bowls had like bottoms. Like if it was just a sphere cut in half, wouldn't it like rock? Okay. But like not all bowls do that, right? So that can't be a comprehensive definition of a bowl, right? Okay, yeah, right here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes there'll be a thing sticking out around at
the edge of the circle of flatness. It's hollow. Gotcha. Which means that there's only like a small part. Hmm. Usually not that thing. It can grow a tremendous, but it's
usually
like those round laundry baskets? Well, okay, so when you say, so it has to have like, it has to have curved edges for it to be a bowl? Okay, so a laundry basket, awesome, good, good news. All right, you can't hold a laundry basket in your hands? What's wrong with your hands?
Bowls, cereal bowls fit like in your hands, like the whole thing kind of like.
Like you can put your hands around it, or, like what do you mean? Yeah, but you could do that with a laundry basket, right? And what about like a bowl that you would like cut up watermelon and put it in a bowl, like one of those big metal ones? Can you hold that in your hands? Okay, Claire, go ahead. What's a bowl? Oh, so a bowl is anything you eat with that isn't anything that's not a bowl. I mean, Claire, does that seem like that's actually defining, like, oh, you're just saying a bowl is a bowl. The bowl is the thing that we call bowl. But I mean, you have reasons that you identify bowls as bowls, right? When you look at a lineup, if someone like shows you a cup, you're like, cup. And you didn't need to know it was called a cup before it was a cup. So what are the come on, guys. You know what a bowl is, right? What are the characteristics of a bowl? Oh, So cups. Enclosed laundry baskets. Yes. Why are we talking about this? All the better if you don't know yet. Okay. Who else? So what is a bowl? Please define for me. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm.
So what about like a serving bowl? Like one? Are those bowls?
Yeah, those are
bigger than cups.
I said taller,
not big. Well, I mean, but aren't they taller than cups often, those serving bowls?
Sometimes they are.
Okay. Seems like the rule's not really working out. Sorry. Kind of a toughie. Yeah, right here. A small basin that holds food or liquid like a Tupperware. Is a Tupperware a bowl? Tuffy. What was that?
There's not usually a lid.
Have you ever seen like a salad bowl that has like the portable lid that you put on it to bring it to the picnic? I don't know what to tell you, but Tupperwares don't have the lids connected. They come off. Yeah, over here. Yes, it's born out of my deep dislike for homeschool students. No, of course. I mean, I teach homeschool students. This is what I do for a living. I love homeschool students. What is a bowl? I actually think, so I do this with my students, and over time, we start to get pretty good definitions of bowls. So I think I have a definition that I think is at least pretty functional. But I'm not like, it's not going to tell you or anything. How would I do that? That's crazy talk. No, I'm not. I'm actually going to let this infect you for, like, ever. You're going to think about this forever. What is a bowl? Okay, just last little chance here. I don't have time to do this whole exercise the way I do with my students because I'm sort of using this to make a point. Back here, yeah. I think that this sort of gets to the point. Like a bowl is the thing that you use that you call a bowl, right? But like the definition of that bowl, where is that? I mean, the reason that I had you agree to the fact that you can actually identify what is and what isn't a bowl ahead of time was so that you couldn't then be like, oh, it turns out bowls don't exist. I don't have a definition. There's no such thing as a bowl. But in fact, there is such a thing as a bowl. The question is, where is the definition? Now, that's going to come back later. There's sort of two things that I wanted to point out with this exercise. That question, where is the definition of a bowl in your brain? Why can you identify a bowl if you can't actually verbalize the definition? Is, I think, interesting. Yes? A bowl is a name. I would disagree because you would, I mean, like a bowl, yes, there is the name bowl and we call it a bowl. But there are things, like if I showed you a bowl that you'd never seen before, and you had never seen that thing called a bowl, you'd still call it a bowl, right? In which case, there is in there some definition of bowl by which you judge what is a bowl and what isn't a bowl. Now, okay, I'm going to have to move on. Sorry about this. We're going to have to move on beyond the bowl activity, though it is a lot of fun. The first lesson, we're going to talk later about where that definition resides inside you. But the other one is I just want to point out that it can be really frustrating. What I actually really wanted is I was hoping you were frustrated at some point to some degree. That the fact that I was pushing back on your ideas, I'm hoping one of you was like, here's the answer to bowl. And I was like, oh, like a laundry basket. And you're like, oh, so mad. Makes me so angry, right? I'm hoping that you experienced a little bit of that. And I want to tell you a story. This is sort of I'm a debate teacher. This is what I do. My job is to sort of push on students until they get really uncomfortable. And I remember years ago, I was teaching this class and I had the most interesting experience. I had a student and we're arguing this basic question. What is the proper role of government? Some of my students will have done this discussion. It's a particularly frustrating one, right? And she keeps, she's like putting out her ideas about like what government should properly do and so on and so forth. And And we get to this point where she wants government to do, like, some things over here. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, I guess based on that principle, it should also do these things over here. And she does not want government to do those things over there. But she's having trouble figuring out how to divide these two. And so she's trying to draw lines in between them. And I, you know, sort of erase those lines. I'm not sure that line really works all that well. And you can start to see the heat rising. And she's starting to get a little more frustrated and a little flustered. And she starts to get shaky. And she's looking at me with, like, sort of daggers in her eyes. And eventually I make this point. And then she blurts out. I'll never forget. It's really funny. She says, Well, you're just a socialist! And that was it. Like, that was the end, like, for her, end of conversation. It was really frustrating for her. And essentially, I was arguing a socialist position. I was saying, oh, well, I guess since you like this, then these things are good. And it just got really, really frustrating for her. The point being, it can be really frustrating when you run up against people who are presenting a different idea than your own, when they disagree with you. And we live in a world where people disagree on all sorts of things. People disagree on religious ideals. People disagree on politics. People disagree on philosophy and, you know, just family issues, all sorts of things. And we live in a world where people really disagree on a lot of things, and that can be very frustrating. It can get so frustrating that it can almost seem like an indignity that you should be subjected to having to share your world with people who are so clearly wrong. I don't know if anyone's ever experienced that. Maybe you felt this to some extent, or maybe you've heard someone talk about things this way. Like, it is an indignity. It is not fair that you have to share your world with people who disagree with you. To give you some ideas, if this does not seem familiar to you, I went to a couple of websites just today and looked up. There are some websites, you just go to them, you look in the comment section, you're going to see this right away. So I went to one that is a pretty far right-leaning website. It's called Breitbart.com. And I just picked up, here's an article, and went to the comment section. Let's see what people are saying about other people. Okay, here we go. This first one is an article about a judge who ruled a way that the people didn't like. Comment. This is from a person whose handle is America First. So there you go. Judge is a piece of garbage monster. That's it. That's what I said. Okay, all right. How about this one? Same one about the same judge. We need to hire private investigators to go through this judge's life and find reasons to have him deported. He is clearly a traitor who hates America and is certainly willing to abuse his court for a kangaroo court. These leftists deserve no quarter. The judge is a criminal. So, yeah, you see what I'm saying? Like, people who feel like it's an indignity that they have to share the world with people who disagree with them. It's not fair that there are people out there who are so obviously wrong, so obviously stupid, so obviously ill-motivated that they just hate people and they hate America and they want bad things and they think what they think because they're bad and they want bad things for the world. You get the idea. Lest you feel like this is a... one more. Yeah, here we go. Different article, same website. The Dems don't give a rat's expletive about the Constitution, the rights, or laws. They are scum. But scum is all caps, so I guess it would probably read like they're scum! Anyway, but it was the only one that was all caps. I don't know. Okay, lest you think that this is a problem of people who are like conservative politics or whatever. Over on the Palmer Report, this is a pretty prominent left-wing news site. Some really good ones. Handle Lens Lord. This one's funny. Okay, not a joke or an insult. That's how you know an insult is coming next. Okay, not a joke or an insult, but this is our current reality. The Republicans are the American Taliban. They believe they have the right to impose their twisted beliefs on everyone, and they enjoy that. They revel in making other people the targets of persecution. They make me sick. I am so glad he did not want to insult anyone. that'd be really sad if he was going around insulting people. All he thought is that they're like over in their secret Republican course, like, how can we make people's lives miserable today? Okay, another one. Maggots, but it's spelled M-A-G-A-T-S, so like MAGA, like Make America Great Again. In other words, his pejorative for a Trump supporter. Maggots are disgusting creatures. They have lost all normal behavior and the ability to be human. That's pretty... I don't know. Okay. How could they turn into such vile, hateful, selfish people impersonators so quickly? Ugh. Okay, one more. This one, I think the irony is so thick here, it is almost impossible to think that like somebody missed this irony. Okay. This one comment says, lady scanning phone. Man asks, so who do you hate today? Lady, I don't know. Fox News hasn't told me yet. Like I said, who do you hate today? Okay. Anyway, you get the gist. Essentially, the idea that you have to share the world with people who disagree with you can be really frustrating. And in extreme cases, it can get to the point where you feel like it is wrong and sick that you actually have to bear to live in a world where people are so wrong that they would have the gall to disagree with what you think and think that they're right and that you are wrong. I think that's pretty interesting. And I think it's important to note that's sort of all the way up, right? It starts at like this frustration, how dare you disagree with me? And it sort of ends with, you're not even human. And there's sort of this scale of feelings toward other people who disagree all the way along the way. So here's the question. The question is, why is it so frustrating that people disagree? I want you to envision this girl that I told you the story about. You know, it's getting harder and harder to defend her position, and she's getting angrier and angrier until she bursts out, you're a socialist, end of story, I win, you lose. And she just kind of can't handle it anymore. Why? And I'm actually curious, why do you think it can be so frustrating to have people disagree? Yeah, Winter. Sort of threatens your concept of rightness that you are right. Excellent. Did you want to say add to that? Okay. It's a really excellent point right here. I mean, like, yeah, it feels good to, like, win. Very excellent. Yeah, right here.
It kind of makes sometimes to make your feelings
invalid. That's, like, a really big one. Like, it makes you feel like it's invalid. Really excellent point. I'm going to take two more, and then I'm gonna move on here. Yeah, go ahead. Excellent, and then Bracken.
Yeah, and kind of coming back off what I was saying, same thought, is that you feel that you have this all figured out and someone's just proving you wrong, so like, you really just get frustrated and maybe at yourself for having not thought through that.
Excellent points. I really appreciate the contribution. I think you made some really excellent points here. I'd like to sort of condense some of the things that have been said and maybe draw out three reasons that I think can be really just very frustrating. Feel very frustrating that people maybe would disagree with you. One of them is the idea that it sort of attacks a simplistic worldview. I want to tell you a story about a study that is really interesting. Okay, So there's a study. It was published in 2021 in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology. And it takes people who it sort of studies the attributes of people and correlates that with sort of like their political worldviews. And we have two things going on. One, they're sort of measuring how much do you express hatred for other groups of people, right? Other groups of people. And then on the other hand, how much satisfaction, how much, what are the specific words here? Enthusiasm, eagerness, and determination do you feel that you have in life, just generally? Okay, so I want you to take a guess. People who express high levels of hatred for people in other groups, not for individual people, this is important, but for groups of people, do you think that they're essentially life satisfaction up, down? It is up! Yeah, or maybe life satisfaction is too large, but at least enthusiasm, eagerness, and determination for life is down. Now, think about this. In correlation, what went down was a sense of inner conflict. What went down is a sense of uncertainty. And what down is a sense of confusion. So what's going on here in this study? I would posit to you that the idea is the concept that the world is a simple place made of good guys who are right and bad guys who are wrong. People you should love, people you can hate, that worldview offers some real comfortable simplicity. You feel determined because you feel like a warrior. I know what's right. I know they're wrong. I'm the good guy. They're the bad guy. And I am a warrior for what is true. There is some real satisfaction in that, some real happiness. I think happiness maybe is too strong a word there, but there's at least some comfortable simplicity in that. And there's definitely a lack of inner conflict that says, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I don't know everything. Maybe there's more to the situation than I've seen previously. So imagine, here you are. You've got your concept, and you know you're right, and maybe you're this girl sitting in this chair, and what's the proper role of government? I know what the proper role of government is. It's clear to me. And someone comes along, and they say, well, are you sure about that? And start introducing concepts that attack that simple worldview that says, I'm right, they're wrong, I know, they don't. Good guy, bad guy, we know how this all goes down. Can you see that potentially being frustrating? That it could result in an outburst? Well, you're a socialist, you're the bad guy. Conversation ended, no more things to consider. I think so, for sure, yeah. That it attacks that disagreement. And a pluralistic society where people, you know, we have lots of different people who believe lots of different things, it can attack a simplistic worldview. It introduces complexity into the equation, and that complexity can be very uncomfortable, very difficult to deal with. let me see if there's anything else I wanted to... So I guess that when you are introduced with people who disagree, you sort of have a question to answer. How am I going to see this? You know, what is it that causes disagreement? Am I going to see disagreement as something that's caused because some people are smart, some people are right, some people are morally good, and some people are the opposite of all of those? Or is it possible that the reason that disagreement exists and that people have different opinions is because the world we live in is a complex place, and that often people are having to trade off things that they want for things that they don't want, or trade off things that they want. I want this thing, but I want this thing more. That there's lots of evidence available on lots of different questions, that people have really different experiences, and that you can't just transplant your experiences into somebody else. You can't just make them see the things that you've seen or experience or feel the things you've felt. Which one of these do you think is a better explanation for the fact that people believe different things? Good guys, bad guys, smart, dumb, morally good, morally bad, or it's complex and people are trying to figure it out? I would tend to think the second one. Okay, so that's the first reason I think that maybe it is difficult to have people who disagree. It's frustrating to have people disagree with you because it starts putting you into that uncomfortable position where you no longer get to decide who the bad guys are. Okay, let's go to number two. Number two, I'd like to tell you about a different study. So this study is a really interesting one. It happens in, let me get the date here. This one is 1959. This is like a landmark study in cognitive dissonance. And it is published in the journal, this is a really interesting title, the Journal of Abnormal and Social Psychology. I don't know what's abnormal about it, but anyway. So this is what happens. They get these study participants. They put these study participants, they pay them to essentially do a task. And the study participants don't know what's going to be done ahead of time for this task. But it turns out this is going to be boring. Like super, super boring. What they actually have them do is they just have like a big board of pegs, and they're in like these round holes. And what they have to do, they just have to turn the pegs a quarter turn, and then like do the next one, and like turn all the pegs a quarter turn, and then they have to do it again. And they have to do it for like an hour, just turning pegs a quarter turn. And that's it. Some of them get paid $20 to do this. This is 1959. Some get paid like $2. And then here's where the real study comes. What they do is they ask them at the end of the study, how much did you enjoy the activity that you did? Okay, so who do you think reported enjoying the activity more? The people who got paid more or less? It was less. The people who got paid less were the ones who said they enjoyed it more. So, what's going on? Here's what the people running the study think. Essentially, this is what happens. Someone has just, you have to kind of put yourself in the participant's mind. Okay, I just signed up for this study, and then I did something terribly, terribly boring for a whole hour, and I didn't even get paid anything for it. I got paid like $2. And they're asking this question, why would I do that? And so they come up with an answer. Well, I know why I did it. Because it was terribly interesting. Because it was so fun. That's why I was doing it. I did it. I mean, of course. And only an idiot would turn pegs in a board for an hour for $2. And this guy ain't no idiot. So, obviously, yeah, I loved it. It was fantastic. That's essentially what it came down to. Is that, and then of course the people who did $20, they were like, well, I got $20 out of it. No, it was terrible, but I got my $20, so I have a good reason for doing the things that we're doing. What this pointed out is the strong internal need of the human brain to be able to justify its decisions. A cognitive bias. A confirmation bias, if you will. In other words, the concept of confirmation bias is the idea that we tend to reject evidence that does not confirm our current beliefs, and we tend to easily accept evidence that does confirm our current beliefs. So, for example, this is really interesting. Another set of studies that happened in another place. Basically, what happens is they get people who are really polarized on the death penalty. I hate the death penalty. I think the death penalty is great, right? And then they go and they show them evidence, right? That they like show them the evidence that on statistics about the death penalty and so on and so forth, and they have them read them, and then they retest at the end. After having read the evidence, what do you think now? Now, they read the same type of evidence, but both types end up being more entrenched in their position. In other words, they're reading the same evidence, but they're not really reading the same evidence. They're filtering out the evidence that confirms the stuff that they believe, because why? Because it is uncomfortable to have your assumptions questioned. It is a deep sort of human need to be right. Confirmation bias is something that makes it uncomfortable to look at the world at the fact that people disagree, and then look out there and have sort of like enduring evidence that maybe there are things you haven't considered, because other people have come to different conclusions. So maybe there are things that are worth considering that somebody else has to say. And that can be very uncomfortable, to run against that natural tendency to confirm your beliefs instead of try to understand what other people think too. On the other hand, there's this really great story about Socrates, and it's written in Apology. So Apology is where Socrates argues that he shouldn't be killed by the Athenians for his crimes. And explains this thing that happened. So he has a friend named Chaerephon. I think I'm saying that right. I don't know. It's Greek, so could be anything. But he has this friend named Chaerephon, and Chaerephon goes to the oracle at Delphi, and the oracle says that Socrates is the wisest of all the Greeks. And Socrates, as he tells it, he's like, I mean, that's obviously not true. I am not the wisest of all the Greeks. I'm like the least wise of all the Greeks. And he goes, and he's like, well, I guess maybe there's something to it. I mean, it's an oracle, so all right, I'll give it a shot. So he goes around, and he goes to people who are, like, specialists in, like, the arts, or in, like, I think he mentions, like, horse training and all these things. And what he does is he goes to them, and he's like, okay, so tell me what you know about these things. And as he asks questions, he always gets them by his report to a point where they're answering questions by pretending to have answers because they need to be right. They need to have all the answers. And he goes and he sees that happen again and again and again. He asks these questions. He gets them all to a point where they don't have answers. And then he says, I understand what the oracle was saying now. I understand that the oracle meant I was the wisest because apparently I'm the one who best understands. I really don't know that much. And that is the beginning of wisdom. And I think that really is the beginning of wisdom, isn't it? To say that that the imperative is not to confirm what you already believe. The imperative is to recognize that as humans, there's lots of things that we don't know. And there's lots of things that we can learn. And so there's not a real need to make sure that you can confirm what you believe, but there is a great need to learn more. So when you're confronted with people who disagree, you could automatically say, okay, well, I'm going to listen to the part, I'll filter out the information that confirms what I already believe. Or you can say, well, I don't know everything. And it's worth listening to other people. Let's go to number three. I think this is maybe the deepest reason. I think that this is the real reason that this girl shouted out at me. I think that this girl really shouted out at me because she believed she would have to agree with me if I could argue better than her. I think that she really believed what she believed for deep reasons. It was important to her. It mattered to her. And I think she felt like if I won this debate, she only had one option. She had to agree with me because I had proven her wrong. And you can imagine why that would be very frightful. Because those beliefs mattered to her a lot. But is that true? Do you have to agree with somebody because they made a point that you can't answer? You really don't have to. This is actually why we talked about the bowl. Okay, here's the question. You guys were, frankly, unsuccessful at defining what a bowl is. Does that mean that you don't know what a bowl is? No, so where was that knowledge? Here's the question. Where did you learn what a bowl was? How did you gain that understanding? Yeah, it's like basically the way you learned what a bowl was is someone said bowl, 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 bowl. There, no one, I can just guarantee, not a one of you ever had your parents sit down and be like, all right, time to learn what a bowl is, son. We're opening the dictionary. A bowl is a separate from its environment concave object whose width is generally larger than its height and does not have handle, you know, so on and so forth. No one's parent ever did that, which means that your definition of bowl entered in subconsciously. It resides in your subconscious. It does not exist at a conscious level. And so it is just a web of words and images that you use and concepts that if you spent some time, and this would work, we could do this over and over and over again, and eventually you would probably pull out what you think is a definition of a bowl. But for the time being, it's just in your subconscious. Now, somebody could say, well, you did not define what a bowl is. You have no idea what a bowl is. But doesn't that unreasonably privilege things that you can logically prove or things that you can explain to perfection? Think about that. Okay, so your bowl... Your bowl, you learned it through this web of associations. How much of the stuff that you know did you learn that way? Would you say like more you learned at a conscious level or more you learned at a subconscious level? Subconscious, yeah. The idea is probably a lot of the stuff that you know. Does that mean it's invaluable? Does that mean it's not valuable? Because it resides at a subconscious level. Essentially, this girl that I'm talking to is saying, well, you disagree, and I need to get you to agree with me so I don't have to agree with you. But just because I can explain it better, does that invalidate the things that she deeply holds? This is to say nothing of the value of spirituality. How valuable it can be to have spiritual experiences that could be hardly explained. Very difficult to prove. Not shareable. You can't give that experience to somebody else or make them believe that it happened to you. In other words, there are experiences that are so valuable, modes of knowing, ways of coming to conclusions that are so valuable that have very little to do with the ability to win a debate. And they are not invalidated by that. One of my favorite books, do I have time for this? What time is it? I have 20 minutes. I do have time for this. Fantastic. So one of my favorite books is this book called Frankenstein. You've probably heard of it, or at least heard of the movie or something like that. Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. By Mary Shelley. Love this book because it's a beautiful, beautiful metaphor. So Mary Shelley was a romantic, and that does not mean that, she did have a romantic life. With Lord Byron, I think, or was that her sister? Yeah, okay, Lord Byron. Anyway, but that's not what that means. She is philosophically a romantic, and the romantic era comes after the Enlightenment era. And so during the Enlightenment era, I think gardens are a really good way to express this. I had a history professor once point this out. She said, you go to the gardens at Versailles, which is constructed during the Enlightenment era, and all of the trees are in like this super straight line, and you have the pathways that are very straight, and the trees are shaped like triangles or squares. And essentially, the idea was that the Age of Enlightenment was the age of reason. It was the age when people were enforcing rationality on society and getting rid of superstition and engaging in science and finding out what logic could tell us. And so they made their gardens that way because that was like the feeling of the age. And then has anyone here ever been to Central Park in New York? Central Park, very different, right? Winding pathways, big rock outcroppings, wild trees, little ponds. Grass just sort of growing all over the place. Rats scurrying around for sure. Lots of that. And I was really interesting to hear my professor say, well, you know, this is made during the Romantic era, which is this response that says, yeah, sure, logic is valuable, but there's so much that is non-logical that's very valuable too. Nature and intuition and spirituality And so that's expressed in the Central Park and in the way that nature is allowed to sort of flourish there. Anyway, Mary Shelley in the book Frankenstein, she's a little bit of idea of like Enlightenment romantic. So she's romantic, and the idea of Frankenstein is that there's a doctor. The monster is not named Frankenstein. The doctor is named Frankenstein, in case you happened in the book not know that. So there's this Dr. Frankenstein. And essentially what happens is he figures out how to create life out of dead bodies. So he pieces together this monster, and then the dead body comes to life. And then he is so terrified, horrified by his creation, that he runs away. And then the creation becomes a monster. The first thing it experiences is this confusing entry into this world, no context. First thing they see is someone horrified, everyone's terrified of him, and then the monster becomes a monster. And I think that the metaphor here is that Frankenstein didn't create the monster. He sort of created the monster when he messed with things that he didn't really understand. But here's when he really created the monster. He really created the monster when he couldn't love what he didn't understand. That if he had the first time he'd seen the monster, seen this thing that was foreign to him, if he could love it, then the monster would never have become the monster. The monster would have probably been rejected by some and accepted by others, but would never have become what it became. And the overall message of the book for me is to learn to love the things that you can't understand. Spirituality is not something that always is easy to understand. Intuition is not something that's always easy to understand. Subconscious thought processes are not always easy to understand. Does it mean that you're 100% right? Just because you don't understand it means that you're right and they're wrong and you're smart and they're dumb? No, but it doesn't. But it also doesn't mean that you're wrong automatically. It means that there's something of value there and you should love those. So when you're faced with people who disagree, you can approach this by saying, well, if they are better at saying what they say than I am, I just got to agree, and I can't allow that. I'm going to have to prove them wrong. Or you can say, well, I can listen to anybody, really, because I don't have to agree with them just because they make sense. Making sense is not the only thing that matters in this world. And I can withhold judgment. I can think about what people say. And I can try to take the things that make sense to me and think about the things that don't. And that's okay. You can take those approaches. I think in all of the three circumstances we've talked about, a simplistic or a complex worldview, confirming what you believe or accepting that there's probably a lot that you don't know, or, you know, feeling like you have to agree with people just because they sound smart or not. In all three cases, I think that the third option is a better option. And I think it opens up possibilities that you don't have in other ways. One reason why is because the second set of approaches allows for something called civil discourse in a way that the first set of approaches doesn't allow for civil discourse. The concept of civil discourse is the idea that we are made better by disagreement. Disagreement helps us on the whole. I want you to think about something for a second. Let's envision the first. I'm assuming you guys are like cool with the First Amendment. That's generally, I don't know, most people like that. Free speech, you like this. Okay, good. I mean, why? Look, you understand that free speech and voting, by the way, means that people who claim that they've been abducted by aliens, they get to talk just as much as like Harvard professors, you know. So what gives, man? And this is like a question. I want your commentary. Like, why does that make sense? That people who are like, you know, like all those clickbaity stories, the people who click on them over and over again, they get to say stuff just as much as anybody. Yeah. Excellent point. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's partially because we feel that sometimes we will be that person who is like, oh yeah, I was abducted by aliens. Not necessarily like we keep saying we're abducted by aliens, but like needing to say a point that will be disagreed with by majority.
Excellent, right here. Very good, yeah. Excellent, yes. Okay, yeah. Excellent, and right here. You want to say something? Did it get covered already? And thank you, and thank you for all of your contributions. I think there was a lot of sort of like focus on the idea that, you know, it's our right and we should be equal and so on and so forth. And these are great points. I'd like to maybe add an element here. What if letting everyone talk is actually like it's not just the right thing to do because they have that right and we should be equal and it will lead to tyranny otherwise? What if it actually helps us produce the best ideas in society? What if, to this point, you say, okay, well, people who get abducted by aliens, well, they get to talk too. Well, what about like people who disagree with the Ptolemaic system of the universe or of the solar system? We're going to let those morons speak. This is, of course, Galileo, who changes our concept of the universe or of the solar system and what rotates around what. I mean, at some point, someone could have been like, oh, why would we let those morons talk? They're idiots. But turns out that he actually has something good to say. And it turns out that he had good evidence that would support what he said. And the concept of civil discourse is if you let people disagree with each other, then over, not in every moment, not in every argument, not in every circumstance, but over the long term of a society and over the long term of a person's life, the best ideas tend to win out. Or the ideas that are the most important to an individual tend to win out over the course of a life. And if you approach life as though it's an indignity that other people would dare to disagree with you, then you really miss out on that opportunity for civil discourse. Listen, I am personally not a libertarian politically. And a lot of people are. But I'm really grateful that libertarians exist in our society because they really do a good job reminding us of just how important freedom is. And you can forget that when you're not a libertarian. They really meaningfully add to our civil discourse. They're important. I am personally not much of a liberal, but I'm really grateful that liberals and progressives exist in our society because they remind us frequently, or at least they remind me, of how important it is to be compassionate of other people, empathetic to the things that people go through. I think they meaningfully add to our discourse. It's important to not feel like it's an indignity that other people disagree because, in the end, we need their disagreement to refine our own ideas and to remind us of things that we don't know. Curiosity about what other people believe is better than simple dismissal because it gives you the opportunity to really consider the benefits of what other people have to say, and you miss out on that otherwise. I've only got 5 minutes, and so I'm gonna skip number two. The third benefit that I would like to point out is that you really get the opportunity, if you can stop feeling like it's an indignity that people would disagree with you, you can draw closer to people. I'd like to share a personal experience. When I was probably like 17. I was in debate. I had a sister who left the church. It was really hard for me. I felt like I was losing my sister, and I felt kind of angry about that. I felt a little bit like it was an indignity that I had to share my family with people who disagreed with me. It was really hard. Painful, as a matter of fact. And I remember there was this time we were in the kitchen, and back at this time there was a project going on. If anyone's ever been to like Salt Lake City and down there, they have like the Main Street, and Main Street used to run through all the way, but now there's like a piece of land that's owned by the church, and it connects Temple Square and the Joseph Smith Memorial Building block. And that had been purchased. And the mayor at the time, his name was Rocky Anderson, he was making an accusation that the church had sort of used underhanded means to acquire that piece of land. And my sister was sort of repeating that. Oh yeah, the church, they did the worst thing. They used underhanded means and they weren't being very honest and so on and so forth. And me, at that point, I mean, that got my hackles up and I was really angry. And I had no idea what I was talking about. Frankly, I don't think she did either. I think both of us felt like we had our position. Good guy, bad guy, right, wrong, and our job is to disagree, and I have to prove you, otherwise I'm going to have to believe what you believe. And we got in a pretty bitter fight over stuff that I didn't understand at all. Like I had no idea what I was talking about, and I don't think she did. And it really hurt my relationship with her for years. She moved to England some years ago, and when she was going... Excuse me. When she was going, I remember giving her a hug, and I knew she was going to be moving to England for, it would be a long time until I saw her. And while I was giving her a hug, I had this vision, not a vision, but a vision of all the years I missed with that sister. All the good relationship, the time I could have had with her, loving, close family relationship between me and her, that I didn't have because I felt the need to make sure that I was right and she knew and I had to defend that and I couldn't listen to her because she was the bad guy and I was the good guy. And I regretted it terribly. I wish I could go back. I wish I could say, okay, well, tell me what you think. Well, I'm not so sure about that. Do you feel like you have good evidence of that? Okay, well, it's interesting. Do you want to hear what I have to say? Oh, you don't? Okay, well, I can just listen to you. I don't have to say anything here. I don't have a need to prove to you I'm right. I can just listen to you. That's fine. I wish I could go back and do that. I'll end with a quote. President Nelson, I'll end with a few quotes. President Oaks, this was from an address at University of Virginia Law School in 2021. He says, "I am distressed at the way that we are handling the national issues that divide us. We have always had to work through serious political conflicts, but today too many approach that task as if their preferred outcomes must entirely prevail over all others, even in our pluralistic society. I begin with a proposition I hope all will share. As a practical basis for coexistence, we should accept the reality that we are fellow citizens who need each other. This requires us to accept some laws that we dislike and to live peacefully with some people whose values differ from our own." And then finally, from President Nelson in the latest conference, "I am greatly concerned that so many people seem to believe that it is completely acceptable to condemn, malign, and vilify anyone who does not agree with them." President Nelson, I think your wife will be better, your world will be better, more complete, more whole, and more loving if you can adopt an approach to the differing opinions that we see in society that says that people matter more than the things that they believe. And that's true of you, and that's true of every person. Every person matters more than the things that they believe. I want to live that way. I'd like to invite you to as well. Thank you very much.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.